Hello, I am Mischievous Mark Giannacchio, and I own every issue of Amazing Spider-Man, Amazing Fantasy 15, and of course, all of the annuals, which I also say do not count.
And I'm Dapper Dan Gavazdin, and I own every issue of Amazing Spider-Man, including those pesky annuals, which I say definitely count. But for me, Amazing Fantasy 15 remains a fantasy.
Such a shame, Dan. Just a shame. Anyway, welcome to the Amazing Spider Talk, the show where two fans and collectors uncover the strange, fun, and fascinating history of the Spider-Man comic universe. Thanks for joining us for this review episode of the Amazing Spider Talk.
Mark, you know, not to go back to the annuals thing and to maybe put like a pin in your cap rather than my own. Like, I saw you were posting on Instagram and revealed something I didn't even know about, which is that there's an annual that counts as the annual for both Volume 3 and Volume 4.
Yeah, it was the 2016 one. I think Umberto Ramos actually wrote part of the script for it with Christos Gage. I was looking this up as I was like, you know, I always try to include like the issue number and the creative team and all that. And I saw while looking it up, people listing it as both a Volume 3 annual and a Volume 4 annual. So, I mean, look, if there was ever evidence that these things are just a racket and total nonsense in terms of like, you know, the continuity of Spider-Man, I mean, how can it be two different volumes, Dan? Come on. It just does not count. And let's just be done with it and stop having these silly arguments, okay?
If memory serves, that's the one where he goes to Cuba and they put the Puerto Rican flag on the front of the book. They mixed up the flag of the country that he was going in. And I believe it like came out either the week before or the week of the launch of Volume 4, because it's got like perfunctory commentary as to the state of worldwide at the time, the Volume 4 book. So like, maybe they felt like because the date preceded the launch of that fourth volume, it counted as Volume 3, or like the volume split that year, so it encompasses both. I don't know how these things go, but that's an interesting little wrinkle for those of us out there who care about numbering or voluming, which is to say, probably the same audience that listens to this show. Either way, if you want to swing along with us on our journey through Spidey's past, present, future, whatever volume or annual we're on at a time, subscribe to Amazing Spider Talk on your favorite podcast app and leave us a review to help spread the word about our show.
This podcast exists because of the support of our Patreon members, even those of you who support annuals. If you want to receive early episodes, exclusive artwork, and keep this podcast going, go to AmazingSpiderTalk.com and consider joining our Patreon.
Yeah, today on the show, Mark and I are going to be discussing Amazing Spider-Man, Volume 6, Number 44, The End of the Gang War. This issue was written by Zeb Wells. The cover and interior artwork is by John Romita Jr., inks by Scott Hanna, colors by Marcio Menez, and of course, letters by VCs Joe Caramagna. This issue was first released on February 28th, 2024. Mark, why don't you hit us with a recap of this final issue?
We open with some Spider-Man internal monologue. Despite this being a war, Spidey thinks they're winning against Madame Mask. The Syndicate is bolstering their ranks. Except Electro turns on She-Hulk. Tombstone orders the reversal because if Spider-Man helps them win, they're all gonna lose. White Rabbit asks if Janice backs this idea, and Tombstone brushes her off, affirming he's the boss now. Luke Cage rallies the troops as Spidey and his allies reassess who they're fighting. She-Hulk refers to one of the Syndicate as Paste Pot Patty, and she brushes that back because it's just Trapster, and we're not doing the whole female names for traditionally male villains, though I still think Elektra is better for female Electro. Other Elektra with a K. But that doesn't mean Mask and her goons are done fighting, and now they're circling the wagons against Spidey and his buddies. Count Nefaria lays the smackdown on Spidey, and even She-Hulk is on the ropes. Except here comes the cavalry, which indicates Luke Cage, Spider-Boy, and Jackpot. Well, I guess that justifies those tie-ins now. Spider-Man is still face down in the middle of Central Park eating lasers from Nefaria and Silvermane, and we try to get a Spider-Man overcoming the odds moment, but instead he gets bailed out by Shotgun, who is no longer under mass control via a sigil. Speaking of which, Shotgun blows the sigils right off Nefaria and Silvermane, and now Madam Mask is rightly screwed. Nefaria and Silvermane are taken off the board, but Mask still thinks she can pack a wallop against Spider-Man. Spidey tells her it's over, but Mask is promising chaos because he interfered. Spidey says, "You shot my friend!" But Mask pulls a Thanos and pleads ignorance of that, basically, I don't even know who that is! Because removing emotional stakes from a story like this in the 11th hour is certainly a creative approach, I would think. Anyway, punch, punch, kick, kick, and Spider-Man tells Madam Mask that she brought everything upon herself. Jackpot comes in and does some action hero stuff, and eventually Spidey plugs up Madam Mask's arm cannon with webbing, and it's officially game over for her. The remaining rats all leave the sinking ship. Shang-Chi and Danny Rand show up, and Spider-Man is like, "Where are you?" And they're like, "We don't know. Spider Office Editorial made us a miniseries for Gang War, but we've just been a non-factor anyway." We have some superhero bickering, and everyone on the hero side is just starting to congratulate each other for multiple pages. Luke Cage thanks Spidey, and Spider-Man talks about the Vigilante Act, and Cage tells him, "Don't worry, that major plot point that initiated this whole story in the first place was basically resolved with no drama off page." So Peter goes to visit Randy Robertson in the hospital, giving him an update on the law being repealed, and eventually Randy is like, "Oh god, I'm tired of pretending to be nearly dead and to create a mascot for the story, so I'm going to wake up and resolve this whole thing." Randy then jokes that he's been awake since Spider-Man gave an inspirational speech to him earlier and said Spider-Man must have taken care of the gang war. Just because Amazing Spider-Man needs to name check the entire Marvel Universe now, Peter makes sure he corrects Randy, his nearly dead friend, to let him know that in fact Spider-Man got so much help and couldn't have done it without them. Randy then asks about Janis, and Peter doesn't know where she is because no one does. So that brings us to Tombstone and White Rabbit. Tombstone just says he and Janice had a disagreement and she left. White Rabbit looks kind of cynical and he lets her know she should be happy because, hey, she got a promotion. Hey, I know what that feels like. Anyway, White Rabbit points out Tombstone only gets to run the city because he teamed up with Spider-Man, and Tombstone agrees with her. He says he owes Spider-Man, so he's going to pay him back by beating him to death in broad daylight in front of everyone else. And we get a final look at the Gang War map that shows everything is being run by Tombstone. Graphic design is Marvel's passion.
All right, Mark, it is the end of Gang War. You know, I wanted to start this conversation off by returning to, I think, the primary question that we asked at the start of this and in our coverage of the original Gang War during our season 6 episode, which is that Gang Wars notoriously can't do both things. Be a satisfying Gang War story that covers a lot of ground and incorporates a lot of bad guys and mixes Spider-Man into it, and an emotional payoff for the characters at the heart of it. We had hoped with the kickoff of First Strike, which seemed to strike that balance fairly well, that this story would continue to balance that out. And I think over the episodes we've been discussing, we've seen it ebb and flow, you know, back and forth between characterization and broad action. But characterization for Lonnie Lincoln and Janice Lincoln and Madam Mask, and not for Spider-Man. But last issue, it kind of started to move back towards Spidey. So my question for you is, do you think by the end of the story that Gang War has managed to pull off that balance? And if not, where do you think the balance went?
I thought you were initially going to ask, like, let's consider the most important thing about this story, which is that Dan Kavazin yet again had another letter published in a Spider-Man comic.
I did, yeah.
I mean, like, who is writing all these letters? It's just you, I guess. I don't know what's happening here.
I do have a continued 100% track record of getting my letters that I write in into the book. You know, this one was a meaningful one for me. It was about my son, like, learning to recognize Spider-Man, which is like something I've not been trying to do. Like, I think, obviously anybody who's watching the video of the show knows I have a whole wall of Spider-Man art behind me. There's almost no way that he could avoid seeing Spider-Man, but like, I really want him to have his own desires and things that he loves. And he's almost 2 years old. So like, saying that he loves something is like kind of crazy, more than he just recognizes it. But I did write a letter in about how he now knows Spider-Man. And since that letter, he has like fallen in love with the character, and it's his favorite thing. He just carries around a Spider-Man doll everywhere he goes. And we've kind of leaned into it a little bit. But, you know, I wanted to commemorate it because it was when I was reading a comic, Amazing Spider-Man, I think it was even First Strike, where he saw the ad for Ultimate Spider-Man on the back and pointed at it and said, "Man," I thought, well, Spider-Man is truly the everyman now, because to my son, he's just man. Yeah. So that was really cool to see that letter printed in the back. And Nick Lowe was super nice about it, which makes me feel kind of bad for what the kind of review we're going to give to this issue. You know, it's nice to write into the book and kind of put some milestones in the book. Although it seems like, and here we go, skipping ahead to the opinions, I always get letters in conclusions to stories that I don't like from stories that I think have great starts. It was like this, Dead Languages. I believe our Dead Language, I got a letter in like, I think issue 26, which we trashed. I have a letter in Shed, the final issue of Shed, which was me like talking about how great Rage of the Rhino is. I don't have a letter in One More Day talking about how much I love Back in Black. That would be the trifecta if I had pulled that off. So safe to say, I did not think this was a very good conclusion to this story. Mark, answering my question, thank you for noticing that letter. I don't even know if you ever read it, because you famously don't read the letters pages.
I don't.
So glad you noticed.
But it sounds like a touching letter.
Yeah. You should go read it. It might move you a little bit. It's well written enough that I can manage to get these things in on a regular basis.
Okay, fair enough. To answer your other question, though, did this strike a bad look? This is probably going to be some, you know, for those of you like playing the Amazing Spider Talk drinking game at home, this is going to be like a prime Mark episode here, because this was an extraordinarily disappointing finale for me for many reasons we will obviously get into here. I mean, you know, in terms of the balance, I'm going to pull back and look at this and, like, you know, the first thing I want to talk about, Dan, is like, what actually did this story accomplish in terms of like what did its execution push forward in the world of either Spider-Man or Marvel? And the only thing I could really point to was the repeal of the Vigilante Act, or what are we calling it? I kind of am confusing like my superhero legislation.
They call it a bunch of different things in the book. I think it's officially called the Powers Act. People refer to it as the anti-vigilante law, things like that. There's the team that's going after Miles, that's like an anti-vigilante task force. So it's got a bunch of, sometimes they refer to it as like Fisk's law, but I think it's officially known as the Powers Act.
It's kind of like how we call like the infrastructure bill, either like the bipartisan infrastructure act or the infrastructure investment and jobs act or build back better.
Like Obamacare.
Or Obamacare. Anyway, so that law was repealed, although it was kind of really done either off page or kind of in concert with like the Luke Cage miniseries, which tune in for Substack this week for our thoughts on gang war as a storyline as a whole in terms of how we felt that those miniseries executed. The bottom line was like, the first strike obviously started with all these like very dramatic moments, you know, Randy's attempted murder, you know, the Miles and Peter kind of confrontation over Peter being a vacant mentor. Just this idea that Peter like owed it to his friends, New York City, to be a more present and their superhero. And I feel like the last chapter here addresses none of this. It's like completely void and vacant of any emotional stakes. I mean, Randy just kind of like, I'm alive again. I mean, like everything about this is just so kind of glib. And here we go, drinking game. Attached with a rivet gun. I just don't know what to do with this. Like, I am like, my mind was so boggled by how vacant and unemotional this resolution was. And it's very difficult to even formulate an opinion. So like, to answer your broad question, no, it did not resolve anything, I think, in a cohesive way that would indicate that there was like a strong thesis and intent behind this story. It was just a lot of issues that included several miniseries and tie-ins of just punch, punch, kick, kick, things happening, and now we're here again. And I don't know what to make of that. So that is my first gauntlet I'm throwing down. Where do you want to take it from here, Dan?
Well, I just want to say, anybody who is playing the Spider Talk drinking game at home has just been moved to a clinic. Like we've been at this so long. And that's to say, like, well, I mean, it's unexpected. Like, this is kind of how stories, major stories, conclude in Spider events under Niccolo's tenure. There's enough correlation between all of these events concluding this way, which is to say, completely uninterested in the themes that are presented at the start of the story. Like, I you and I have been around this long enough that we're like, look, if a story doesn't conclude definitively, you know, that's the nature of serialized comics, right? Like, a bad guy will be defeated and then there's a backdoor exit that they got out, and you're like, okay, like, so long as this chapter feels, you know, something I can engage with and feels whole, I'm fine with stuff being unresolved, you know? But this kind of like, I mean, yeah, we do get a to be continued literally at the end of this story. That makes me think that this is kind of like part two of a 3-part gang tombstone story that we're going to get. But I still require these individual things, especially if it's been elevated to an event, to feel, you know, coherent or thoughtful on its own. And I don't think that this, like you said, adheres to that. And I don't think this is necessarily a throwaway story. I think there are genuinely positive things to say about Gang War as like a mid-level Spider World story. But I think elevating it to an ASM event without a proper story for Spider-Man shows a real lack of understanding of the priorities of that title and what this line needs overall. If you can't sell us on Peter Parker's story in an event, it's going to damage everything that is caught up in it.
This is a legitimate question of mine, Dan. I mean, like, did this need to be as dense and multi-pronged of a story as we got? Because personally, I don't feel that it was justified by the way this comic was resolved. I mean, like, no, was like you said, is the whole thing just like, you know, let's just throw the baby out with the bathwater and say it's all trash? No, it's not that. But it's just like, why did we go through all this? Because like, it didn't feel like where we ended up necessitated 6 issues of Amazing Spider-Man, a prelude issue. We're going to have an Aftershocks issue. How many miniseries, one-shots, Marvel Unlimited one-shots? I didn't even realize until you told me the other night, Dan, that Spider-Boy had something on the digital, like a digital one-shot. And it's just like, what are we doing? This is so unnecessary. Like, this is just an overload of content that didn't really do anything.
I think it really all comes down to the execution, because I think there is a really valid way to tie up all of New York into an event like this. And I think it got off to a pretty solid start. Like, there is something of like even just the map, like the map, I think, was a really great touch, you know, in maybe a story that wasn't otherwise very satisfying. And I even want to commend that final image of the tombstone on the map was a cool note to go out on. Like, you know, like, oh, this is Tombstone City now. Like, what a cool visual representation of that. Like, Jonathan Hickman is onto something with these data pages.
Right.
Don't quote me on that, because a lot of them have been wasted. I would rather get a page of artwork and writing than a data page. But like, I like that idea of, here's the spider team. We're going to all go off and defend our own parts of New York and come back together in the end. Like, that's kind of exciting if it's going to be managed well. But I don't know that we ever felt the true ebb and flow of that, you know, outside of maybe the beginning of the story. And it kind of got derailed with the whole Kingpin thing, which we talked about to death. But like, to your point, I really think there was something here. Like, this is a cool potential stage for a good story, and a stage that I think was established fairly well. I mean, especially if you've been reading all of the other books, you know, Miles has been dealing with this vigilante squad. Daredevil has been dealing with Fisk's Law. Like, it's been a presence throughout the Marvel Universe. Like, putting it all up and elevating in this way, I think there was something really like a clever idea there. And I don't want to take that away from them, because it's a good idea. I just don't think they really ended up doing much with it.
No. And look, I'm not going to sit here and like rewrite storylines the way I wanted to see them, because like, I just don't do that. But like what you just described, I mean, we're talking about like heroes talking about the consequences and the repercussions of Fisk's Law here. Like, I would have been very interested in a story that really kind of like told the difficulties and stakes of that. But that's not what we really got here. I mean, it was kind of like name checked in the background of this story from the get-go. And like, you know, it was Randy like kind of railing against it that led to him being targeted by Hammerhead, which, by the way, what the hell happened to Hammerhead? Because we haven't seen him in like 4 issues. It really wasn't a driving, like the driving drama of this story became the Lincolns versus Madame Mask and this story of like daughters who were trying to kind of seek the validation that they never got from their fathers. And then even that, I don't feel was truly explored in a meaningful way in the end of this storyline, because, you know, the previous issue, you have Lonnie literally ripping the wings off of Janice and she just disappears. And like, I'm assuming we're going to get some kind of check in with her in the next comic, or is there going to be a Omega issue or something? Or
it's not actually an Omega issue. It's just kind of like it's advertised as dealing with the fallout of the story.
But so it's within the confines of Amazing Spider-Man, right? It's not a, okay. So I, yeah, cause it wasn't a one shot, because I think otherwise we would have been in the checklist or something that we've been getting. But like, that's the thing. It's like, so we'll have a post-conclusion, I guess, maybe, that checks in on Beetle, or maybe not. We don't know. Even from the daughters of the mob, you know, underworld's villain characters, I don't feel like we necessarily got a resolution. It was just kind of like there.
Yeah, and that's the one emotional story that they like deigned to tell, and then they just let it go. I mean, even in this issue, like Madame Mask, like her father is on the battlefield fighting for her. He gets the sigil turned off, which gives him free control. And like, that could have been a real moment for like reflection of him as a father, you know, in the same vein as Tombstone. And no, he just gets blown up and he's knocked unconscious. And there's no thought to that, which is like something that was really, they spent time establishing. And, you know, maybe he, like Zeb Wells, ran out of pages or whatever, but like, that's a part of doing this, is like figuring out the focus of your story. I mean, I think we so got lost in the twists and turns of all these gangsters, like Madame Mask sleeping with Hammerhead so that she could take control of the Magia, and Kingpin returning. And it's like, none of that added to anything. Like, none of that came to, it was so caught up in like twisting us, and We still don't know what the hell the guy with the purple boots are, or like why Shotgun had adamantium bullets. I mean, maybe the government gave it to him. There's just so much that was introduced and never followed up on. It's like, get rid of that stuff. Like, a good editor should have helped this thing been pared down to what's at the core of it.
I mean, look, like you said a few minutes ago, like we can't sit here and expect like every single loose end to be tied up in a story like that. That's not the nature of serial comics. I'm not saying that's an unfair expectation. That's not what I'm putting out there. But yeah, like, you know, if you're setting up these like twists or mysteries or something, and the purple boots is like, to me, the most egregious personally. I mean, like, I would also like to know where is Hammerhead, because we've seen nobody, but whatever. But the purple boots thing, like, it was kind of set up. And I think at the time we were even like, is this Norman Osborn? Where has he been for the last six issues? He was such a crucial part of Amazing Spider-Man. And like, now he's just completely off the board. So like, it would have made sense. This could be like something really critical to like the overall story, even if it turns out that like the whoever was the owner of the boots didn't figure into the storyline. But if it was just like, oh wait, no, that was Madame Mask, duh, like you didn't even address that, like you didn't like show it in any kind of way as a follow-up, like that's just like sloppy storytelling, sloppy editing. It's just the bottom line.
I mean, my read on it right now is it's literally not another person, it's just a miscolored boots for Madame Mask. Like that's my current read on it. But like, who knows, in a couple issues, I could find out that it actually was another human being. And okay. But I mean, even stuff like Hammerhead. So you spend all this time with like introducing, I mean, not to mention we've never checked back in on the lawyer for Tombstone that was introduced, you know, in early chapters of this. Fine. She doesn't have to be a part of this. She seemed to have been set up as a crucial part of this. Fine. Leave her out of this. We've got Madame Mask pretending to be this woman so that she could sleep with Hammerhead and I guess like trick him and take over the Magia. A few issues later, we find out she can control people's minds. So like, why even bother going through all that unless she just wanted to like nail Hammerhead, like put a spell on him, take control over him, and it's done. Like,
Nail Hammerhead. Like, I see what you did there.
Are we just like you used for to describe Dan Slott that like his comics writing is like jazz, but like this literally feels like they were making it up on the go. Like, oh, I guess she has like magic powers now, and the Hammerhead thing was like just to get her rocks off, so to speak. I don't know. I'm not going to lean into more hammer metaphors, but I appreciate you catching my joke there.
There you go. Are we gonna have like a candlelight sigil with Hammerhead now? God.
That's a Spider-Verse reference for those of you who are new to this whole thing.
Which I would say like resolve things better than this, but now I'm like getting crazy, I think.
Okay, so speaking of Spider-Verse, let's talk about Spider-Man and his role in this. I got to admit, opening this book, I was like, okay, all right. Like, we started off in Spider-Man's head. Like, we're reading his monologue. I'm like, okay, we're back. And Spider-Man's like kind of justifies it in the opening. He says, in war, there's no time to think. And it's like, oh, okay. Like, I'll buy that as like why we didn't get inside of his head until now. Like, I'm willing to give you the benefit of the doubt, book. Like, you're doing something with Spider-Man. He was so narrow-minded and focused that we haven't gotten much from him. You know, but then it kind of quickly goes away and we're like, and Spider-Man has very little to do. And I'm like, no, I am not going to give you the benefit of the doubt on this, because here's the problem. Like, we've been saying it, Spider-Man feels like a backseat player in the story, but even down to the ending, like he is literally pinned against the ground and being ramrodded by these guys, like these supervillains, and he doesn't save himself. Shotgun just out of nowhere turns off their sigils. Spider-Man is saved. And how does he defeat Madame Web? He webs up her gun and it explodes on her. And I do think there are some good things here. Like, his speech to Madame Mask is like fairly well written and, you know, plays into the roles of responsibility and things like that. But like you mentioned it in your recap, there is an overwhelming odds moment sitting right here And like, maybe I would have rolled my eyes to see Spider-Man like push back against the laser and use his like feelings about Randy and trying to save Randy and prove that heroes have a place in the same way that he tried to save Aunt May with the serum and lifted the lead off of him. And he lifts the laser and punches out Nefaria and goes after Mask. I maybe would have rolled my eyes at that, but at least would have been a big moment.
Where do I start here? I do want to say, like, as a starting point, I think you're being far kinder to the writing here than I think I would be. I like a lot of this comic to me, frankly, like from even just from a sheer dialogue standpoint, especially the dialogue attributed to Spider-Man, which I think kind of speaks to a larger problem with this comic book right now. Like, it just felt like dialogue that is like masquerading as insightful and important, but is really just kind of like name checking and you know, telling, not showing, storytelling. There, you can drink on that one, folks. Like you know, in our notes here, in war there is no time to think. It's like, look, again, like I feel kind of like cheap being this kind of critic right now, but it's like, when has Spider-Man ever kind of talked like that? Like, in war there is no time to think. Like, it's like it just feels very hollow and unattributed to anything really at the core of Spider-Man. And then, you know, when he does confront Mask about Randy, again, it's like the you hurt my friend. And yet, you know, and she's just like, I don't even know what you're talking about. Like, I didn't do that. Like, and it's just, even in the moment where maybe there is some emotional sizzle to what Spider-Man is trying to do, like the writing then just like undercuts it immediately and robs it of any of its kind of emotional backbone here. And like, I'm not going to assume roles here, but like, I've seen Zeb Wells write a lot better than this. And this felt very edited. It just, it read very elementary style. Like this was not of the level that I would expect from a flagship Marvel character in a comic book in the year 2024. I got to be honest with you, Dan. Like, I was very just disappointed in the sheer rhythm and cadence and crescendo of the dialogue. Like, it was very just kind of flat and bland and cliched and cringy in parts. And like, I did not get any emotional tenor at all from any of this.
I don't even know if I think it was like edited more than it feels like kind of phoned in.
Yes.
Like
maybe that's what it is.
This is the part of the story where Spider-Man should say a rousing speech. And so I'm going to have him do that. But like 90% of Spider-Man's dialogue through the past several issues is just like, you hurt my friend, as like almost a reminder that that happened. And like, it doesn't explore that in any depth. Or like, I mean, I guess the idea is like, hey, you started this war, and so you're just thinking about yourself, but there are casualties. There are, you know, people who are caught in the crosshairs. But if that was the theme that this book was about, it needed to be a lot more about that, like a lot more about the people of the city. And it had not that this, you know, there was plenty of room to explore that across, you know, a half dozen titles.
Yeah, and I want to stop you on that, Dan, because like, I was even thinking about this recently, like just the sheer setting of this final battle. Like, I, you know, I know last episode I was joking about like, you know, having this like big fight in the middle of the Great Lawn of Central Park, but like, you know, one of the themes that we were allegedly trying to establish in the first few installments of this storyline was like, you know, like you said, like this impact on New York, and this is Spider-Man City, and don't, you know, you can't do this. And like, where was the emotional climax of this story, or the physical climax of the story? It's like in the middle of a field in broad daylight with no one else around except for a bunch of like villains and AIM people just fighting each other. Like, go back to JMS and JRJR and Moreland, like rampaging through like, you know, thick Manhattan and throwing civilians into danger and into fires and forcing Spider-Man's hand to respond. There's none of that here. This is just like such a vacant, isolated, in a silo moment of Marvel characterdom. Like who cares? Like, what are the stakes here? Like let them all kill each other and like the rest of the heroes can walk away. Like, what's at stake here? Nothing. Like, there is no risk or any kind of heart to this whatsoever, the way they just staged it.
At least in like Spidey's first hunt, we had that scene in the tunnel with cars blowing up and like it felt dangerous. And Paul and MJ got caught up in the mix, you know, like that felt very like personal. Like there were real stakes there and real danger and utilization of like the world of Spider-Man. Yeah, I totally agree with you. It's such an odd choice. Especially when this book started with that scene with the ringmaster, like controlling those like citizens and like incorporating them into battle. Like that was a really like harrowing and disturbing scene. You know, when we read the beginning of this with First Strike and then that as the opening scene of Gang War, like I was really hooked. I mean, I'm sure it came out in the review of the issue. It was like, oh, wow. Like what a take on this.
Everything that was set up in those issues just feels like it was abandoned. And then and in terms of your point about like, oh, well, if like Spidey did this here, maybe I would have given it an eye roll. And like, look, maybe I would have given it an eye roll too. But like at least it would have shown some effort to like trying to get some heart here. And like every opportunity that this creative and editorial team had to really bring out some heart like was just overlooked or bypassed. And that's just like, it's like as a reader, that's just dispiriting. Like it's just like I'd rather roll my eyes but like smile at something than just like be like, oh, well, no one really seems to care. And that's where I'm kind of at with a lot of this stuff right now. Is there anything else you want to add to that before we get to the next topic?
I mean, I also want to say that Spider-Man, I think his relative inaction here also undermines the conclusion of the story. Like, Tombstone suggests that he has to take out Spider-Man to not look like he's working with him, which I think is a fine, like update to the conclusion to World Without Love, the first story of this run, which is like, oh, like that treaty that they established is still going to blow up on Tombstone and force his hand to have to hurt the guy that helped him out and kind of helped him save his daughter. But like that only really works if Spider-Man legitimately saved the city. And we felt like he had a strong role in doing that and proved that heroes had a place in it. And like something that threatens Tombstone's newfound power in that Spider-Man didn't really like, it seemed like a perfunctory role. It, like the whole idea of Tombstone having to make a big show of it, like because Spider-Man was so instrumental in fighting back against the gangs, it rings completely hollow. Am I looking forward to like a rematch between Spider-Man and Tombstone? Of course, because I actually like the way that Zeb writes Tombstone. Like he comes out of this, I think, the best of anybody, you know, as a character. And, you know, I'll give him another whack at it because that first story with Tombstone was so strong. Or even maybe have Spider-Man do something with Janice. I don't know. But like his inaction goes against the very thesis of the ending of the story, I felt.
The conclusion with Tombstone makes Spider-Man and the other heroes that he was aligned with look like a bunch of chumps here. I mean, like even in the very beginning of this comic where, you know, the syndicate all of a sudden starts like, turning their blasters onto Spider-Man. And like, there's no like real like acknowledgement or sense of like, oh crap, like the dude we've been siding with for the last four or five issues, whatever it's been since Tombstone joined the fray, he's betrayed us. And like, there's no recognition, there's no acknowledgement, there's no, you know, none of the characters here are like, holy crap, like, you know, like, you know, you made a deal with the devil. We've kind of gotten Tombstone journey with that. Like, you know, he acknowledged from the get-go, like, well, you know, like people are going to see me with Spider-Man. What are they going to say? And then like, we kind of get the conclusion here was, well, you know, what are they going to say? What are they going to say when they see me beat him to death in broad daylight? But like, this isn't the amazing Tombstone. This is the Amazing Spider-Man. And like, you know, what about Spider-Man? Like, you know, like and doing this 2 issues from now or next issue, whatever, whenever they decide to do it, isn't good enough here. Like, this is a major turning point in this comic. You know, Spider-Man has already got, like, you know, he's already having his against the odds moment, just trying to neutralize Madame Mask, and the person that he's been aligned with, like, stabs him in the back, and there's barely a blink of an eye to it, and with the other heroes, and you're just like, do they not understand? Do they not care? Like it's just so odd to me. It's so dissident. Like we're not acknowledging just the sheer facts. We're not even being like, oh, I wish they would have done this. It's like, it's just like things happen and we're not acknowledging what's happening. It's like gaslighting comic books. I don't understand what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, I mean, like there should have been a whole scene of Spider-Man wrestling with Tombstone's betrayal. Or, like, even have him lose because of Tombstone. Like, if this is part two of this three-part story, which I think it is, and clearly the ending suggests that it is, like, then this is the Empire Strikes Back. You know, like, this is the time to do the sad ending, and that final page of Tombstone taking over the city should be very mournful. I mean, I think they were going for that. But, like, it should be mournful on the behalf of Spider-Man, not on our behalf of the understanding of the Marvel Universe. And I guess it is a little bit mournful that Tombstone feels like he had to become a monster, like, you know, like, and basically carry out what his daughter was doing, which was she was letting everybody else fight her war for her, and she was going to come in and clean up, you know, and Tombstone ostensibly, like, forces everybody's hand on that. It doesn't feel particularly monstrous, as Tombstone suggested. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, what is monstrous here? Like, look, I'm not saying to make this like a rated mature comic book here, but like, if Tombstone's truly a monster, like, where's the body count here? You know, like, have him like rip Shotgun's head off or something. You know what I mean? I'm serious though. What are the stakes here? Again, I you know, take a drink. Mark's talking about stakes again, or gravitas. There you go. I'll say that word. But seriously, what is Tombstone being in control of everything actually mean? And yes, I know more comics.
Honestly, it seems better. He's a reasonable dude.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Matt, we have been conditioned over the last 6 issues to think, well, Matt, if Madame Mask owns everything, that's bad. I mean, we don't know why it's bad, but it's bad. Trust us. It's bad. Source, trust us, bro. What is Tombstone having the whole map mean? Like you said, like yes, we're not advocating for charts and infographics in our comics, but I made fun of it in the recap, but I didn't, you know, yes, seeing that at the end, it was like, oh, that is a good piece of, like, you know, of resolution here. Seeing
it's impactful. It was, yes, legitimately impactful. Yeah.
It was legitimately impactful. And yet, like, what does it actually mean? Because, like, all we know it means is, like, you know, Tombstone, you know, made the call that he's the boss now. So the syndicate, quote unquote, turns on Spider-Man. And then Tombstone just kind of like disappears into the ether. And it's just like, yeah, I'm the boss now. And I'm going to kill Spider-Man next chance I get. But, like, so what? Like, yeah, you know, everyone says they're going to kill
Spider-Man. Everyone's going to kill
Spider-Man. Otto's been saying it for 60 years. So what? You know what I mean? Like, give me something to care about here. And
can be a monster in the eyes of people that care about him. So, like, if we saw it from, like, Janice's point of view or Spider-Man's point of view, it would be great to get it from Spider-Man's point of view, given that he's the titular character. Then we can see what that betrayal means and how much, like, of a monster that he's become. But of course, we don't get any insight into that. It's just another punt down the field. And to me, this reminded me of Last Remains in the Spencer run, where we, like, entered into that story and we were like, this is it. This is going to be the end of Kindred. Like, it's sold as the big thing. Like, let's put all of our investment into this. And at the end, it was like, nope, this is another 25 issue like story that you're going to have to invest in. And I don't think this is going to go that long, because I don't think Wells is going to be on the book, you know, past XDX issue to make it all that way. I may have some knowledge about that that I'm referring to here. It's so frustrating, because it's like, I was here for this, you know, like give me a conclusion to this. And no, just no. They refuse to do so.
Did Lonnie kill Janice? No. I mean,
is she in a trunk somewhere? Yeah, I mean, what is going on?
Like, we saw her rip her wings off and now she's just gone. And it's just
she's just in a gimp suit in a trunk somewhere in someone's basement.
Look, I'm not advocating fridging another female character here, but again, if we're going to project Lonnie to be this monster of monsters here who had to make the ultimate call to be the boss, then, you know, where's the beef? We don't have it, you know, it's all just you trust us. We got this, you know, this is the story, you know, the Nick Lowe art and craft of storytelling here. Why don't we take a quick little diversion here, Dan, because I'm getting a little revved up.
No, we can't have that. Tune in for. Well, if you want to hear more of Mark and my extended thoughts on Gang War, the entirety of Gang War, Mark, where is the best place to do so?
I would say it is our Substack newsletter. That's right. We're not former Amazing Spider-Man writers who are now going to Substack. We are Amazing Spider Talk podcasters who also have a Substack, and it's amazingspidertalk.substack. Did I get the address right, Dan? You should probably correct me here.
It's amazingspider.substack.
There we go.
I think Amazing Spider Talk was already taken, weirdly enough.
That's probably someone trying to get us to pony up for it. Amazingspider.substack.com. In this current issue, which you might have in your inbox by the time you listen to this, if not, it's coming. Dan and I are going to be talking about Gang War as a holistic story and whether or not it met our expectations. I mean, you could judge for yourself based on how I'm ranting right now. We're also going to have some B-title reviews, including Ultimate Spider-Man number 2 and the new Spider-Punk Arms Race. It is completely free, which, I mean, how can you not love that? You know, every other issue, we talk about the current state of affairs, and then we have some nostalgic stuff. I mean, what is not to love about this newsletter, Dan?
It's an awesome outlet for all of our talk about Spider-Man, and we've gotten some really great feedback from people. So if you haven't already checked it out, amazingspider.substack.com, go give it a subscribe, and let us know what you think in the comments. We would love to hear from you. But in the meantime, let's get back to talking about Amazing Spider-Man number 44. And Mark, I want to talk about the moment that I think made me the most upset in this comic, which I'm calling Deus Ex Shotgun. This is maybe Chekhov's gun, although I don't know how set up that was. This is a God from the shotgun. We are in the middle of this battle, and here comes Shotgun, wielding a shotgun, not how a shotgun works. This is a sniper rifle level of ability. Not sure if people know, but shotguns spray bullets. Maybe he's got a tricked out shotgun. You know, far be it for me to judge. But I thought the whole idea was that they sprayed bullets powerfully in one direction at short range. But here is Shotgun using his sniper-like style to pinpoint accurately, shoot off the sigils on both Count Nefaria and Silvermane. First of all, didn't know sigils affected by bullets. Maybe he, alongside adamantium bullets, got these anti-spell bullets. Fine, it's comics. I'm willing to accept it, you know? What a dumb way to end this. Spider-Man, pinned down, could rise up and be the hero, but nope, we've got to have, some betrayal from Shotgun. Clearly been elevated to the level of supporting cast character of Kamala Khan. What do you think about this moment, Mark? I have to imagine you feel similarly about how dumb this is as I do.
Long time supporting cast member Shotgun. This is so silly and this was just a bunch of nonsense. That's how I'm gonna just dismiss this, because honestly, the level of thought and care that went into this, I think, kind of warrants that kind of dismissal of that it's a bunch of nonsense. I mean, yeah, it's Spider-Man getting bailed out by the cavalry yet again, except in this case the cavalry is Shotgun. Yeah, you talking about shooting the sigils off. I mean, Sigils in of itself being a major factor in the storyline just like makes my brain want to melt. So watching a shotgun shoot the sigils off of somebody, just like it's just like doubling down on the insipidness of this whole plot line here. That like, hey, look, like we can have a character control people through magic and then have a shotgun remove the magic. It just that like. What are we doing?
I mean,
here?
Granted, this is the second time we've had magic shotgun in like the past several runs, right? You know, like don't forget the Sin Eater and his magic shotgun. I think we need to figure out what's going on in the Spider office in regarding shotguns. To me, the problem, and you've highlighted, is like, and play your drinking game, everybody. Like, this renders the entire fate of the story down to Secret Skrulls. Right. It is a magic, uncontrollable thing that just happens and saves everybody in the nick of time. And, you know, it's really frustrating. I mean, you could maybe say the same thing about Spider Island and the magic helmet that can talk to all spiders. But that's like seeded in a meaningful way and also comes back to play a huge role in Superior Spider-Man. I don't expect that we're going to revisit shotgun and these sigils anytime soon. But to me, this whole thing was set up as a morality play. We have all these scenes of Tombstone and Janice and Madam Mask talking about their, you know, morals and how corrupted they're going to be and like how far they're going to take this. And ultimately the actions of Tombstone, Janice, Spider-Man, heck, even Madam Mask never come to a head. They are just rendered obsolete by magic rather than any kind of like value system that elevates one of them over the other, or even, you know, hell, like, you know, like a stick-to-itiveness that says, I'm not going to give up. I'm Spider-Man. I don't get beaten down. Like, none of that comes into it. It's just, can you turn off the sigils with a magic bullet?
Again, I'm not trying to rewrite the ending of the story here, but like, you know, I had kind of thought like a critical part of Gang War was Spider-Man kind of aligning himself with these characters who were, you know, for various reasons, kind of like, I don't know if I can trust you, Spider-Man. Like, you've been kind of a bit of a unreliable person in my life for the last umpteen months or whatever it turns out to be. And it's not like that partnership is what kind of say, like, look, I'm not going to say that like Spider-Man has to just like beat up Fire Lord every time we have a story like this, you know, like he's allowed to get help from his friends. That didn't even really factor in. I mean, in fact, like the friends were kind of being taken off the table too, you know, like everyone is down and it's Shotgun.
Yeah. His good friend Shotgun. Yeah. Who he's like, never talked to.
Yeah. Shotgun. Who's like, you know, like his whole storyline is like, oh, well, I was there to keep tabs on Janet. It doesn't add up. It like, you know, again, these are like figments of ideas that have all been kind of like socialized to varying degrees over the last few months, but like nothing is fully baked. This is not a fully baked cake in any kind of way. This is just like little like foom, 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 like let's just see what sticks, you know, like Shotgun's gonna save the day now because, you know, he's got his reasons. I like, yes, very disappointing, very nonsensical and silly. I think that's just what I'm going to keep saying.
The best charitability I could give to it is like, this is like a morality tale where Madam Mask used magic powers to, you know, use that overwhelming power to control people. And she ultimately gets undone by the very people that she was controlling. Like, okay, sure. Like, if I really wanted to look and come up with like what the storytelling rationale was, that's the direction I would go in. But like, nothing was ever done with that, like, you know, as a core theme. And so why pin the whole thing on that if that was actually the thing they were going for? What do you think of this Randy scene at the end? I mean, I thought it was like, you know, it's kind of weirdly heartless of him to play that trick on his friend, though, you know, Romita Jr. draws it in such a warm way. There's no way to like read it and not get caught up in some of the emotion of the moment. I mean, like his open face characters, like there is something like human there but it does feel so perfunctory and largely unearned. Just as like a, hey, we needed a way to give Spider-Man some stakes in this, and we're going to use this as like cynically as possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think you described it pretty accurately just there. We set this entire story up as this kind of being the watershed moment that puts Spidey into action and makes him want to make a better difference and to do better than what he has been doing. You know, that stirring speech from Robbie Robertson in First Strike, I think I described that as like, this is a moment where you kind of just let the history of the characters actually set the pace of it. You don't necessarily need to spell it all out. Well, like, look, like, I mean, Robbie's not even in this scene in any kind of way. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's just like, oh yeah, okay, Randy's back. Am I glad that Randy's okay? Sure, of course. But like, maybe this is a moment where Peter peels back the layer and it's like, hey, I'm Spider-Man. You know what I mean? Like, what are we advancing here? Nothing advances. It's just like, Randy was doing this, then he got shot, and we thought he was gonna die. He didn't die, and now he's back, and then what? You know, like we're just like we're back to the status quo in a very kind of milquetoast way, and I don't know what to make of that. I don't know what I'm supposed to glean off this as a reader that's supposed to make me excited or intrigued about this outcome in any kind of way, where it's just like, okay, well, I'm glad Randy didn't die. He didn't deserve to die, but so what? I mean, like so what is kind of like the, you know, the operative term of this comic right now. It's like, okay, he's back. It's not like him being in the hospital was the rallying cry for the vigilante act to be repealed. We don't know what the
we don't know. Yeah,
it just happened. Like it's done. Hand wave. We got it. You know what I mean? Like you know, like show me the hearings where like here's Randy Robertson. He was rallying against this and he almost died because this is how important this is to us and we need to take our city back. None of that. Like, these are just things that happen that really have no outcome whatsoever. I don't know what to say. I mean, like, it was a good moment, I guess, but that's about it.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Robbie. I think it's a real shame that he wasn't here because like Robbie's whole thing, when he encountered Tombstone, was like, look, we at least have a shared humanity of caring about our kids, you know, like, and they placed trust in Tombstone to save, you know, like his daughter, right? Like, and what does that mean that Tombstone betrayed them and Janice? Like, can he be seen as a villain, even though he may have ultimately done the right thing to save his daughter? Like, and maybe Robbie could recognize that and realize, like, he still does care about her. There is still a good guy there. You know, like, Robbie is the kind of smart guy that could cut through that. And I don't want to rewrite this either, but I'm going to rewrite this as if I was Dan Slott. Because this is what Dan Slott would do with this scene. He'd have Randy wake up, open the hospital window, because Dan Slott loves elevating characters probably beyond where they should be elevated. Like, Liz is now running Alchemax, right? But like, what he would do is literally have Randy open the window and he would shout out to everybody outside and give a big stirring speech like, I clawed my way back from death, and this is how important it is. And they would take Randy out on their shoulders and Luke Cage would be shamed by like breaking the vigilante act. And Randy Robertson would become like a candidate for mayor of New York City. Like, he would 100% do that. Right. And we would both look at that and go, that's so silly. Like, Randy should never be elevated to that position, you know, but you know what, Dan Slott, like, God bless you, fictional Dan Slott for doing that in another universe, because at least it would have been something.
That's pretty brilliant, Dan, I gotta say. I like, yeah, we would have been like, yeah, I don't want to be a hypocrite here and be like, I would say that was brilliant. No, I'm not going to say that was brilliant, but I will say that I would prefer that to this. You know what I mean? I think that's the bottom line. And you know, this was something, yeah, you got me on a tangent here, Dan, by having Dan Slott rescript this retroactively.
I want to be clear. Fictional Dan Slott.
Fictional, like, Dan Slott.
My worst characterization of Dan Slott.
Dad Slot's going to be on Twitter not acknowledging that it came from our podcast, saying, I would never do that, because that's what Dad Slot does. Anyway, what I was going to say is...
Red Goblin.
Yeah, exactly. To Dad Slot's credit, I was thinking about this too. Like, I used to say this about parts of the Nick Spencer run. Like, I had a lot of problems with some of the things that Dad Slot would do, but like, I never felt a Dad Slot story was unresolved. I never felt like a Dan Slott story didn't move things forward. I didn't always like how it moved things forward. And this is a case in point. Like, we're presenting these stories as like these big ideas and these big consequences. And then when you actually look at the action on the page and like what the consequences are, and like nothing really moves forward. Nothing is really like big or radical or different or like really shaking up the foundation. It's just kind of like, okay, let's move on to the next one now because we're going to do something else now. And trust us, it's going to be the biggest thing ever. Like, Dan Slott didn't do that. Like, Dan Slott like put his money where his mouth is. He did stuff. You could never accuse a Dan Slott story of being boring and being milquetoast. You could accuse it of a lot of other things.
Cut to us saying these stories are boring and milquetoast from back in our catalog.
From like volume three. Okay, well, volume three aside.
Volume three aside.
I mean, seriously, I don't think I ever thought Dan was boring. I think there was times where Dan was like, oh, he wasn't focusing on character.
He was sloppy in his plotting or whatever.
Exactly. But like, yeah, like Randy, like making this his resurrection be like this like watershed moment of his career and possibly this game-changing moment for the city of New York is exactly in Dan Slott's wheelhouse. And it is like exactly the polar opposite of what we got here, which is just like, hey, I was just pretending to be in a coma. Like, what is that? Like what are we doing here?
I am so glad that we have a new cast member on the show, which is fictional Dan Slott. But what are you going to do?
Oh, God. Anything else on this comic you want to mention, man?
I mean, we haven't talked about the art, and I don't know that there's like a bunch of big new like things to say in this story, which is to say, like, I think this is stellar work. Like, no complaints. Like, the production, the people behind the production of this book, like the hard, like, physical stuff, like, not the ideas, the real things that make this a book, whether it's the people who are working and printing it, you know, et cetera, like everybody nailed it. Like JRJR brought it for this book. Like there are bodies upon bodies upon bodies crashing into each other. Like this is a well-constructed like comic book. You let JRJR cook, like this guy is going to deliver stuff for you. But he can only do so much to elevate the writing, you know? And I felt the emotion from his characters in the scene with Randy. Like, these are two like lifelong friends connecting and celebrating that they're alive. But when the writing doesn't back that up, it renders them just like hollow mannequins, you know, beautiful mannequins at that, you know, like the whole team kills it. It kills themselves. And it's got to be frustrating. Like, you know, I don't know what JRJR's story sense is, like, because he seems to be really having a good time on this book, which great. Like, I think he's done a lot of really cool stories in this run. And I don't want to take it away from him, but it is a shame to see him put so much hard work into a comic like this that's not supporting him in any way.
These are attractive, well-composed comics with the very large caveat of, you know, the problems of the actual story kind of inhibiting it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like one of the things that I kind of thought about, and I don't know if this is necessarily a ding on JRJR, but it's like when the cavalry shows up, like Mary Jane is Jackpot. And it's just like she looks like so disconnected from the action. Does this character realize that like she is like the ex-girlfriend slash, you know, well, we don't consider her the wife anymore, but you know what I mean? Like there was no like emotion to Mary Jane showing up, but like, I don't know if I can ding JRJR for that because.
Yeah. I mean, who's to say like how much Marvel method is going into this, you know, like if it's on JRJR to like, they said like, give MJ a great big entrance and he didn't do it, then yeah, that's on him. But from our perspective, we can't really tell. Like, to me, the introduction of Spider Boy and Mary Jane here felt like an editorial being like, can you throw them into a panel or two? Because we need to like keep people remembering that those characters exist rather than a, like a functional part of the story.
Justify the tie-ins. Yeah, no. I don't fault JRJR for that. But like, it was just like, it was a bit of a oh, right moment for me, because it was like, otherwise, like visually, it was, there was no connection to anything. It was just like moored from an unreality of the whole thing. But yeah, I mean, like, Romita Jr. is a freaking master of his craft here. Like you said, like, even just the inks, the colors, the lettering, everything that goes into the production of this comic is A1 steak sauce here. There are just some other major deficiencies going on that, you know, are unrelated to them.
I've also heard that the people who write into the letters page are genius.
I mean, they are. If I only I read the letters page, Dan, I mean, you know,
the funny thing is like 60% of the letters in the letters page are our listeners. Like, I know them by name. I'm like, oh yeah, that's the guy that listens to our show or contributes to our Patreon or whatever. So Spider Talk is well represented.
The next gimmick we have to establish, Dan, is I need to start like writing into the letters page, but none of my letters get published. So like, then it becomes this thing of like, why aren't my letters getting published? Everyone else's letters, but like mine, you know, like what, where is my secret sauce? I think that
we'll have to see if we can make that happen. I mean, like, to Nick Lowe's credit, he's printed negative letters of mine as well, you know, and it was nice of him to say like, oh, hey, thanks for writing in again. You know, you're considered part of the Spider family. And like, that's all really, really nice. And, you know, I write in, my secret is I spend time writing those letters to make them sound intelligent. You know, it's the biggest trick I ever pulled. And also that, like, I'm going to write in respectfully whether I like it or not. I mean, hell, I might even write in about this issue. We'll see. Maybe my passion has burned out and it's been channeled into the Substack, but you're sitting on something there. You have something you want to say.
No. I'm good. What do you got?
Okay. All right.
Do we want to get to grades here?
Why don't you give us some grades? Yeah. What are you giving this book?
Oh, Dan, I'm going to give this a D-. We are not at an F, but we are barely above it.
Yeah. This one is a D for me. I don't know that I'm quite as negative as you, but I'm certainly not positive on this book. There we go. Mark, why don't you take us home?
Well, it is that time. Time for all good things to come to an end. So we want to say thank you to you, the listeners and viewers, for tuning in to this episode of The Amazing Spider Talk.
Mark, I wanted to revisit this appearance you did on another podcast that I made fun of in the last review, The Runs. Still a terrible name for a podcast. You went on that to defend the start of the JMS run, the Coming Home arc that you and I have professed our love for. And you know what? It was actually a really fun listen. I went and immediately listened to it after our episode. And if anything, if you guys want to hear Mark not playing the like negative Nancy,
the heel,
like, yeah, he's not playing the heel, and he's got the like level of fanboyish optimism that I have on an episode. It was weird. It sounded like you were channeling me for an episode, and you know, maybe my narcissism, that's why I enjoyed it so much. It was cool hearing you defend something you love, which, you know, we do fairly often on the show, but like, usually you and I are in lockstep. So, you know, by whatever design, we didn't pick it that way. And also, like, I felt like the host of that show made some really good points about like why Coming Home doesn't work for him. And of course, it works for me. But like, it was great to hear two people like actively acknowledging and not tearing each other down over like why one thing would work for someone and not for another. So I wanted to plug it again. The Runs, a really solid episode from you appearing on that show. So thanks for telling us about it, Mark. It was a lot of fun to listen to.
I appreciate that, Dan. As I texted to you when you mentioned like that, wow, you're being positive for a change. Look, I swear to God, I like comics, people. I really do. I wouldn't be here if I didn't. So I'm glad that side of me got to come out a little bit here. So there you go.
Yeah. So go check it out. Again, that's The Runs Podcast. Terrible name. Unless you got diarrhea.
I didn't do it. It's not my podcast. Yeah.
Maybe the next episode I go on and I talk about how much I don't like the name of the podcast. And that can be the back and forth. That might get a little more heated. Yeah.
I will put the word in with you and Ryan. There you go.
Okay, so. Great. Well, anyway, enough about that podcast. Let's talk about our podcast, Mark. This podcast that you just got done listening to exists because of listener support on Patreon. For only $3.99 a month, which is less than a standard issue of Amazing Spider-Man these days, you can help support our show's existence while getting early episodes, including these reviews the same weeks the comics release, exclusive artwork, and a ton of other bonuses. It truly is like a special place for our listeners, and we really hope you all consider checking out our Patreon. So again, a thank you to everybody who already supports us and the work that Mark and I do.
Dan and I really want to increase all of the awesome work we're doing in 2024. So if you're already a Patreon or want to become one, please help us to meet our goals and make this a better podcast by considering supporting our show. Just go to AmazingSpiderTalk.com and click on the big Patreon button to get started.
Yeah, stuff that we're already doing, like those interviews with Steve Orlando and Melissa Flores, and we even have another few lined up coming down the pike. Like, those things happen because of the Patreon allowing us to spend the time to do them. Anyway, this podcast episode was edited by Rick Coast. The video version of the show is available on YouTube and was edited by Alex Galucky. Our artwork comes handcrafted by artists Ron Friend, Sal Buscema, and Nick Cagnetti. Our theme songs were produced by Rylan Bojack, Tony Thaxton, and Spider Madge. And our animated intro was created and performed by Josh Sutton. So, Mark, until your ex-girlfriend and the 10-year-old kid you allow to fight crime under your name show up to interrupt our show at the last minute, what's our motto?
God, that feels like oddly prescient to my life right now. With great podcasts, there must also come the Amazing Spider Talk.
Don't miss the next installment.
Is this the point where you tell us that your son, John, you've commissioned as a crime fighter and you're totally okay with him going up against supervillains under your name?
I plead the fifth.
This is all to say, I think Spider-Boy is deeply irresponsible on the part of Spider-Man. So anyway, take it or leave it.
This is where we get like the Curb Your Enthusiasm theme again. Boom, yeah. Boom, boom. Ha ha ha.